I'm going to be presenting some data from the qualitative phase of the study that James just described, but wanted to let you know that the Google Earth process is so fun and interesting, both for the participants, but also for the folks who are running the study, that a new phrase is entering the lexicon, and we're interested to see if it eventually permeates throughout the community and perhaps more widely, and it's called dropping pins. So where do you think you might drop some pins this weekend? So if it happens before the end of the study, we're in trouble, because then we've actually affected the environment, and that's not necessarily, but anyway. Okay, so I have nothing to disclose. And again, we want to thank the men who participated in these studies. We really hope that this work is going to contribute to a healthier world for lesbian, gay children, youth, and adults. And as Jamie said, we dedicate this work to Peter. Okay, so what's happening in New York City is that we're seeing an increase in infections among very young men. And we're seeing a continued racial disparity in infections among young MSM between 2005 and 2009, with black and Hispanic men having highest levels, much higher than white and Asian Pacific Islander men. And this is just another way of looking at it. We're seeing here, of course, that there's elevated diagnoses for black men in all age categories, but that, again, the issue around black men of color black MSM and youth are a big concern for us in New York City and nationwide. We are approaching this work trying to understand what contributes to what has been termed these syndemic health outcomes. Ron Stahl has written an entire book on this. There's a lot of literature on it. We see that gay and lesbian bisexual adolescents have higher rates of substance abuse. We see more smoking. We see elevated risk of mental health disorders, anxiety, mood, and substance abuse, and of course, suicidal plans and thoughts. Last year around this time, we were confronting what seemed like an epidemic of youth suicides in the gay community among young gay men in particular. And it was around the time that the It Gets Better campaign really hit. I'm sure you all remember that. So we're approaching it from this perspective of trying to understand these syndemic health outcomes. And again, this is just more data on that. So our overall research question is, how do urban neighborhood characteristics relate to these syndemic health outcomes? We have this two-phase study that Jamie has just described. The qualitative phase had 20 in-depth interviews in the quantitative phase. So I'll be talking about some of the results from our qualitative phase. So we have been working on applying these three very related theoretical perspectives, the socio-ecological, life course, and intersectionality, to understand how place and sexual behavior relate. And I'll say more than sexual behavior, mental health and well-being. So here we're going to focus tightly on how the men in the qualitative interviews experience their physical space in terms of both race, ethnicity, and emerging sexuality. We're analyzing it through an embodiment perspective, drawing on the work of Bourdieu on suffering and place and resilience, which, sorry, Ron, meant to put Stahl in there and probably some others, theoretical lenses. So again, we're describing how the lived experience of race, ethnicity, and sexuality intersects with place to characterize risk and resilience. And the perspective that we take is this very, very broad perspective, starting from these macro level forces through these social systems, so the race system, the sexual orientation system, the gender system, the class system, how this works through social processes that prop all of this up through these social psych approaches. Coming through the inner psychic processes and how all of this plays out in these life spaces, home, work, neighborhood, family, community, sexual neighborhood, play neighborhood. And these neighborhoods for New York City This is a map of New York City, and what we're looking at is how this all manifests in some of the higher HIV prevalence neighborhoods in New York City. So the four neighborhoods that we actually looked at, so these are just maps of HIV prevalence, are some of the neighborhoods that have higher prevalence. But they're also neighborhoods that are characterized by poverty and a large proportion of the population that are not white. So for the qualitative phase, in order to be included, a man had to report being a biological male at birth, engaging in anal sex, 18 years or older, and to live in one of these four neighborhoods, Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen, Harlem, Washington Heights, or Fort Greene, Brooklyn, again, for at least 12 months. James did all of the interviews. They were about an hour and a half long on average. Men received compensation. This is just a description of the men who participated. The majority of them were either African-American, Latino, or multiracial. 15% were white. Most of them self-identified as either, all of them self-identified as either gay or bisexual. Seven men were born in New York City, and seven of those seven men were either Latino or African American. And five out of seven of those men were HIV positive, and seven of the men were HIV positive. We used in vivo to analyze the data. We read through the transcripts. Developed codes, we developed more codes, we read through the coded text, pulling out emergent themes, we did some comparative coding analyses, and James and I are the primary analysts of the data. So today I'm going to present accounts across three major areas, accounts of home and natal neighborhoods, so the neighborhoods that these men were born and raised in, the intersection between their emerging sexuality, sexual identity, and sexual behaviors, and this racialized experience of place, and experience of place and migration in response to intersection among these systems. And we're hoping also to identify potential impacts on sexual health and well-being and to identify places potentially for intervention. And again, we're working with our colleagues in other areas to do this. So in general, the men interviewed described their natal neighborhoods in terms of physical and social conditions and characteristics, social cohesion, social norms, availability of gay role models, spaces, and support. Generally, men who grew up in the stable and up middle and upper class areas describe them in terms of how well they met their needs, their social needs around education and activities. Men who did not described being physically constrained by the dangerous environments in which they lived. Almost all men, however, describe negative experiences in their natal environments around their emerging sexuality. That's not necessarily anything new. So here's some data from this. Some of the men interviewed described their suburban neighbors, again, in terms of how well they nurtured them. Andy said, it's a gated community. It pretty much had everything we needed. It was a paradise. Another man described it as, oh, it was very quiet and suburban, a little more conservative, generally white and middle-class neighborhood. The educational and economic conditions of these neighborhoods were noted mainly by the middle and upper class men. What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in? Oh, it was upper middle class neighborhood. It went to one of the top 20 high schools in America. Really good public school. So they had boarding school, great neighborhoods, no gangs, very together families, a lot of very wealthy people in the area, no gang activity whatsoever. That was how the neighborhoods were being described. Other men's childhood neighborhoods were quite different. They focused on the danger that surrounded them. It was tough. I grew up in a neighborhood, there was a big crack epidemic, and there was a crack house in a one block radius where I grew up, so it was pretty tough, a lot of gang violence. It was tough to see, but, you know, that was normal to us back then. It was definitely unsafe. I mean, you couldn't be out past a certain time. 7 was the latest. That was, like, late. You know, the sun was down. We had to be upstairs, he means. There was a lot of gang violence. There were rumbles between the projects. Many men interviewed described feeling trapped in their natal neighborhoods, relating to the social and cultural norms of it. So, interviewer asked, tell me about Staten Island. Miguel, I hated it. I just felt trapped. Kind of sucks out there, still does, because the mentality of the people out there, I don't know, it just seems a little more closed-minded compared to certain parts of New York City. And other men described their natal neighborhoods and places where there were no gay role models as being boring and stifling. It was boring, narrow-minded people. I was dealing with my sexual issues, trying to understand myself, and I didn't feel I had anyone I could relate to. So in order to avoid, you know, I guess the depression I probably could have gotten myself or fallen into from dwelling on my issues, I tried to keep myself busy. It's kind of a boring place. There's nothing really to do. You go to school, you hang out with your friends, you go home. There's nothing too upsetting. I was really eager to get away from there. In contrast, one man who grew up in Miami, interestingly enough, and described it as possessing a sexual culture, described that as allowing him to be free and open and comfortable with his sexuality. It was very Latin and hot town. It was a very sexual place. He loved that his culture was very expressive. We were never pure botanical white people from Iowa, you know. I'm thankful where I grew up. This man consciously made this connection between that environment and his ability to be out. Again, this is from childhood. These are their recollections about their natal neighborhoods, their childhood neighborhoods. Because, you know, many of these men are children as they're experiencing this, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So in describing their neighborhoods, the men interviewed at times describe them in ways that suggest that they're aware of the racialized experiences of place, so a very Latin town, generally a white middle-class neighborhood. More often, though, they describe the socioeconomic conditions that indicated either the social position or status of the residents. The self-segregation of middle and upper classes into geographically remote or restricted areas was described by the men. They identified gated communities. They knew it was a restricted community. And the men living in poor areas did use terms like ghetto and projects, and many men used language that suggested a restriction of movement and ability to be gay. They felt trapped. In terms of the intersection, then, so using this intersectional approach between sexuality and race, ethnicity, and how that plays out in space, some of the men who grew up in New York City, again, all of whom were either black or Latino, described the difficulty of emerging as a young gay man in their natal neighborhood. Everybody, and so I'm obviously not reading these, I'm just sort of picking out some things, and I have the presentation if you want to take a look at it. Everybody kind of looked out for each other. You know, you knew the neighborhood, everybody's parents disciplined, it wasn't like today, it was great. My sexuality was probably the only thing that was challenging. Other than that, everything was great. It wasn't real popular to be young, black, and gay in the projects. I had to do some masking. It just came naturally for me to be gay, but you soon became, you know, aware that your surroundings did not promote that, so you had to kind of have a double life. You know, and how did you know your surroundings didn't promote it? They called you names. You were considered less than. It made sense for me as a further protection point of view to create another persona and not go with the one that they were ridiculing. Rodney describes it in this way. He describes having to enact the dominant masculine norm in his Brooklyn neighborhood. I had to show interest in females. I wasn't really interested in the beginning. I had to show interest in that. I had to scale walls. I had to balance on a fence and jump over, throw rocks at squirrels. Because I wasn't, and then when asked, was there a place for someone like him in his neighborhood? Yeah, because I wasn't like, you know, gay faggot. I guess I had proved myself that much to where I wasn't looked at as that. But I wasn't like down. So I was kind of in between. I don't know if that makes sense. It only became confusing for me when it became clear that people were more uncomfortable with me than I was uncomfortable with me. Because I was okay with me, you know. And as it became clear that people was uncomfortable with me, being the people pleaser that I was at the time, that's when I began to start trying to do some things to change. I started dating girls. My sexuality took a shift. The things that I did with men went a little underground at that point. And then he goes on to describe how he begins to move his sexual activities, which had been taking place in a safer environment indoors in a private bedroom, into the parks. And drugs and alcohol began to take an effect at that point. Started off with beer, marijuana. I used to, and then this is a turning point for him. I used to hang out with this guy and his family. He was big with drugs, and he was one of those guys where he had a reputation for, like, hanging out with guys. He had this straight persona, you know, he had a girlfriend and all this stuff, but he had this reputation for hanging out with guys, especially younger guys that he would shower with, you know, stuff, and stuff would happen. So I started hanging out with him, and that's when the drugs really progressed. Cocaine, heroin, yeah, I was 16, 17 with a problem. And then now it's getting into the sexuality, sexual identity, and then sexual risk as it's playing out in his natal neighborhood. Condoms wasn't one of, when asked about condoms, condoms wasn't one of those things that you had ever heard about, STDs with this older guy. This was kind of towards the end of our relationship. He was my best friend's brother. But I remember one time he tried to penetrate me and he used the plastic that goes on the outside of the Newport box. That was the first time there was any kind of barrier that was ever introduced. Especially when you talk about condoms, I didn't know anything about that until he started trying to use that barrier. This man develops a drug addiction by age 17, but he's clean and in recovery at 21. He then, when asked when he moved to Harlem rather than back to Brooklyn, he describes Brooklyn as being unsafe for him, as it obviously was unsafe for him. I grew up in Brooklyn. I really didn't like Brooklyn. No, I never felt safe in Brooklyn. Had the whole project mentality. Asked about why he couldn't move somewhere else in Brooklyn. It wasn't only in Fort Greene. It was everywhere. It was Marcy. It was in Crown Heights. It was Bed-Stuy. It was everywhere. I would come to New York, and by that he means Manhattan and Harlem in particular, and I would hang out, and I would never feel as threatened as I would in Brooklyn. So he moved first from Brooklyn to Harlem and then to North Carolina, where he spent a long time as a HIV and substance abuse prevention professional, and eventually moved back to Harlem later in life. I felt like I could be myself at this particular point. When I came back to New York, I was really totally okay with my sexuality, even my status. So he converted pretty early. I felt like I escaped. You know, I couldn't get out of Prospect Park when I was living in Brooklyn. You know what I was saying? And so what he describes is that even after he was clean and in recovery, he would continue to revisit the parks where in Brooklyn and engage in high, unprotected sex, very risky sex. And he physically described it. He said at one point later, I felt like I'd never get out of that fucking park. He felt physically trapped in that park, even though he was in recovery at that point and much more stable. And it wasn't until he removed himself first from New York City and then went back to Harlem, which is for him was a safer community. So this brings this issue of social distance, because Manhattan was, you know, was right across the river from Brooklyn. So some of the men who were born and raised in New York City and other urban areas felt unable to travel to Manhattan or access the gay, local gay community that is actually quite close. I didn't come out here because I didn't identify with anyone gay. I didn't even know what gay was. I didn't step a foot into Manhattan until I was 19. My life revolved around Brooklyn. You know, everything happened in Brooklyn. It was such a tough neighborhood. We were just worried about getting through the day. We weren't really looking to, you know, go to Manhattan, do sightseeing. You just went to school, came home, you stayed on the block. That was day-to-day living there. And similarly, Peter, I didn't know anything about that when asked about gay spaces. I didn't think about a gay space until I was like, okay, well, the relationship is over. He had a long-term relationship from, again, childhood with a man in his neighborhood, another child, you know, young man in his neighborhood. All I know was that people used to say gay people hang out on West 4th Street. So I went down to West 4th Street, and just walking around, he found Christopher Street. He made friends with them and the village, and here I sit today. So he found the gay community. Another man, Pedro, who was raised in Chicago, found his gay youth community center, Boys Town. But it wasn't in his natal neighborhood, but it was in his a more affluent neighborhood. So every Saturday he told his mom he was going to the library. There's no way she was ever going to find out. It was like in a white neighborhood, and we lived in, you know, a brown neighborhood. So there was like she had no reason whatsoever to be on there, nor anyone that I knew. And to me, it was like I hit the lotto, you know, because once I realized you're not the only one, you're not this, and you're not going to, you know, and you don't have to be miserable or depend on someone who, you know, who wants to hurt you. That was just like, that's it. So many men describe migrating from their natal areas to urban or gay areas, searching for a place where they could simply exist, because there was no existential possibility for them in their home community, or that's how they perceived it. So one man described leaving Puerto Rico. He said, as a matter of fact, I don't think there's a place down there for a gay person like me, because it's either drag queens or men that are married and fool around. So there's no place for a gay man to just, still be a man. Another man described moving from Staten Island to Tampa in a slightly different way. He said it was a new environment where he could present or consolidate his developing identity as a gay man and integrate a gay self. And in Staten Island, he knew a whole lot of people, and this gets to the issue of the social networks that potentially constrain identity development. They knew me as someone I wasn't. So when I went to the new place, nobody knew who I was. It was a little different. I had my first boyfriend and everything. I just kind of opened me up. And so when I came back to New York, I was gay. And what we also saw was that some New York City men, born men, ran away literally from impoverished neighborhoods and abusive families. So this is an account from a man who was physically abused by his mother and eventually left home. Similarly, Peter had an experience where he was outed in his community and says once it came out, it spread like wildfire, and he moved and stayed away for a few years, and he actually only moved about 5 or 6 blocks. I moved out, but I wasn't living on the block, so his world was on his block. He didn't go around the relatives. He didn't answer the phone calls. He stayed away, and when asked if those 5 or 6 blocks was enough, he said that was enough for him. So this distinction between physical space and social space and physical distance and social distance emerged quite strongly. Okay, so through this research, we found that the men interviewed shared their practical knowledge of their neighborhoods and presented and their present-day neighborhoods and how places affected their lives. We interpreted these accounts, though, through the lens of these intersecting structured systems of oppression, again, along the axes of race and class and sexuality. And we're hoping to draw out more in terms of the, how that manifests in terms of both suffering and resilience. What we noted was that men of color born and raised in New York City offered accounts of their early childhood and natal neighborhoods that suggest being physically trapped in dangerous neighborhoods, also physically trapped in their homes or their buildings because you could not leave the house after a certain hour, which are obviously direct manifestations of institutional racism, which you can look at in terms of racial segregation, over-policing, under-policing, and all the ways that people end up trapped in their neighborhoods. Their focus was on surviving and day-to-day concerns. As they grew older, though, and they got out of the house and out of the neighborhood, they bumped up more against not restrictions on physical movement, but against the social norms that prescribe these dominant masculine norms and heteronormativity. Men born into the higher SES levels or areas where safety and survival were not at issue described physical constraints but didn't necessarily offer accounts of the negative they didn't describe physical constraints, but they did offer accounts of negative effects of heterosexism on their lives. These men were really eager to leave their natal areas. They said on several occasions, I couldn't wait to get out. But getting out was something they articulated and it could imagine doing, and they did it as soon as they could. But nearly all the men described feeling trapped in their natal environments, but the lower SES men were often doubly trapped. They were trapped in poor neighborhoods that were dangerous with open-air drug markets, poor quality schools, and few employment activities. Again, these manifestations of structural racism. And then they were trapped again as gay men. And this is all despite the relative proximity to the gay neighborhoods of Manhattan for these men. And so, I don't know what happened to my slide. How did these men's natal neighborhoods affect their sexual, mental, and social health and well-being? Well, we're exploring these potential roots of influence more fully, and this is obviously where some of the practical implications come into play. Through this concept of embodiment, but obviously creating an alternative persona in growing up from a very early age in childhood is problematic. This concept of underground sexual activity in dangerous areas without barriers or without the adequate knowledge of how to use barriers correctly. engaging in a lot of sex with women and girls at very young ages, potentially for high rates of STI acquisition, at much younger ages than perhaps we are aware of. Engaging in criminal and dangerous activity, again, for resources and for identity creation reasons. Engaging in exchange sex, intensified by low income. Obviously, feelings of depression, anxiety, and despair and hopelessness that are go along with these things. This concept of the existential lost, having no gay role models, spaces, or things around them. And then, of course, the stress of adapting to the various personas or moving back and forth across space and time. With this work, we hope to show how these experiences reflect these overlapping systems of oppression and constitute, again, both social suffering and reflexive and conscious rejection of suffering in search of comfort, joy, and passion. And I don't think we've done as good a job of that today, but we do hope to work more of that in how men sought out pleasure and fun and passion as an antidote and a pushback against so much of this constriction on movement. And again, getting more specific in terms of how this is being embodied, how this is being written onto the body, and how men are talking about this experience very viscerally. I know I'm running out of time. And so through this, though, however, we really do hope to pull out more of what we call this transcendent hope, and this idea that it does get better, but also understanding that it can be better in place and time, and that men found better in some of their childhood experiences, and thinking of those as spaces for enhancing the goodness that is there and the positive effects on their mental health and sexual health. And again, as we extend this work, we hope to connect more strongly to how gay men resist and develop resilience in the face of oppression across time and space. And here's our village. It's the same village as James's presentation. Thank you very much.